just like a living room, or what he imagined a living room in an Indian house might look like. There were couches and a few chairs in vibrant patterns, a rug, potted plants in full bloom. In the corner hung a wide wooden swing. The walls had been painted a warm color and adorned with framed photographs. In the center, sitting cross-legged on one of the couches, was a young man in a simple white tunic. Heimu Joshi. This is his living room, the amnesiac realized. They had recreated it here to try to spark something during his therapy.
I have a visitor for you,
Dr. Avantikar said from behind the amnesiac. Heimu looked at him blankly, waiting for more information from her. The amnesiac smiled. It was a new, wonderful feeling, to meet someone who didn't already know more about him than he did. In fact, who didn't know anything about him at all.
He's also lost his memory. Everything from the moment he was born until just a few weeks ago.
Heimu's eyes slid to the carpet, to where the amnesiac's shadow stood patiently behind him against the fibers.
He lost his memory in a car accident, she clarified.
The amnesiac felt her hand on his shoulder.
Please make yourself comfortable.
She pointed to the only giveaway the room was actually a medical facility, a rectangular two-way mirror hanging in the center of the same wall as the door he'd used to enter.
We'll be just on the other side if you need anything.
The amnesiac sat down on the plush chair opposite Hamu's couch. Hi, he said when they were alone.
Hi,
Heimu said. He was studying the amnesiac's face intently.
Do I know you?
Not in the slightest, he said. We've never met before. Heimu perked up then. Something new. Not a replay.
And you really remember nothing? Even with the shadow?
It was due to an injury. My head hit the windshield at a bad angle. So they tell me.
What's a windshield?
The front window of a car. Heimu squinted for a few moments, trying to make sense of the words. Not important, the amnesiac said. I hit my head very hard, and it damaged my memory. Heimu studied the smooth scar where the amnesiac's left eye should have been.
And you won't regain your memories someday.
My doctor is hopeful, but the chances are very slim. Heimu looked down at his hands for a few moments.
I hope you do, he said.
I hope you do too. Heimu studied the amnesiac for a while, pondering something.
What was it like when you woke up? He asked. Could you even speak?
Oh yes, I could speak, the amnesiac answered. It's complicated, retrograde amnesia. That's what they call mine. You often remember the way things work, but not your personal experience of them. I knew what a mother was, but not anything about mine. How to read, but not how I learned it. I remember the rules of football, but I don't know if I've ever played.
That's interesting, Heimu mused. I'm forgetting, but not in any order. I don't know what they call it, but I remember primary school before it, and university after. There must have been something in between, but it's blank.
You still remember more about yourself than me, the amnesiac smiled.
Heimu scrunched his face up, thinking. Suddenly he sat forward, his expression intensely serious. Do you remember what sex is?
The amnesiac laughed. He liked this Heimu. They waited for Dr. Avantikar's aides to peel off the adhesive backings and apply the sensors to their foreheads and temples. It was more normal to do it with someone else, the amnesiac thought, as he watched them brush Hamu's hair out of the way and stick a little white circle above his dark eyebrows, then attach a thin cable to it.
Of course you already know, one of the aides said to them both, but please refrain from large or sudden movements so as not to disconnect the wires.
Heimu watched them file out and close the door behind them.
The way your amnesia works, you wouldn't remember your favorite food then, would you?
He asked the amnesiac. No, unfortunately.
That might be for the best, he said. I still remember mine, and it makes what they feed me here that much worse. So healthy, so tasteless.
I like your food, the amnesiac said. Indian food, I mean.
Not this stuff, he sighed. It's all just medicinal mush. I want something different, like American food.
Yeah, I want American food.
What American food do you like?
All the stuff you can get in the Western restaurants downtown. Pizza, French fries, macaroni and cheese.
He paused.
You know, they say that in the latest stages, the shadowless forget to eat. Apparently it's happening with some of the others in Nashik. They're fitting them with stomach tubes now so they don't starve or dehydrate.
Oh, the amnesiac said, looking down. The thought was horrible.
Hemu glanced around awkwardly. He held his hands in the shape of a small brick.
I met an American tourist near the cricket field once, he continued, trying to steer the conversation away from the dark place it had gone. He told me about a sandwich Americans eat as children. A jelly peanut sandwich?
A peanut butter and jelly sandwich, the amnesiac smiled. He pictured it in his mind and wondered if he'd also never had one.
Hemu nodded. Yes, that was it. That's what I want, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
I can try and get you one, the amnesiac offered.
No, I'm sorry, Hemu apologized. I didn't mean to impose, I was just complaining.
I think it would be no trouble, the amnesiac said.
He considered their hotel. He was sure the lobby restaurant could make one if he asked, or at least tell him and Dr. Zade where a Western grocery store might be so they could buy the ingredients themselves.
I'm grateful, Hemu said. Only if it's easy. Please don't go out of your way.
Really, I'm happy to.
Hemu nodded thoughtfully.
I want to share something with you, to repay you for the sandwich.
Oh, you don't have to, the amnesiac protested, but Hemu waved him off.
It's not much, really. Given...
He gestured to the room, to mean his enforced stay in the hospital.
I really can only give you memories. That's basically all I've got.
Well, I've got them for now.
The amnesiac bowed his head solemnly. There's an old story from our mythology, sort of related to all this.
Hemu nodded at the amnesiac's shadow.
Have you ever heard the legend of Surya, the Hindu god?
The amnesiac said. In these first few weeks of my life, probably not.
Hemu sat up straighter, visibly pleased. The amnesiac knew the expression all too intimately. The pride at knowing something the person to whom you were speaking did not. It was the closest simulacrum to personal memory either of them could experience.
Very important. He's chief of the Navagraha and presiding deity of Sunday. Surya rides a chariot drawn by a horse with seven heads and has four arms in which he holds...
Hemu paused to collect himself, realizing he was getting carried away.
He's one of the oldest gods. From the Rig Veda, the oldest book. The oldest memories, in a way. Not that any of us were there, but we all know the stories. We all know them in almost the same words. It makes me happy to think about them, to realize I still remember them too.
He put up a finger to indicate something important was about to follow.
The point, though, Surya is the god of the sun, and his consort was made from a shadow.
Now that seemed like something that might go somewhere. The amnesiac wished they'd given him a notepad, or even just a piece of paper.
Really? He asked.
Hemu nodded.
In the Rig Veda, Surya marries Sanjna, goddess of clouds, mother of the two Ashwins. Those, the Ashwins, symbolize the shining of sunrise and sunset. Each one crosses the sky once a day in their chariot, bringing either the light or dark. They...
He paused again, scratching at one of the sensors.
Sorry, he said. The twins are also beside the point. Sometimes I just... It makes me happy to realize how many details about something I still remember, if that makes sense.
The amnesiac shook his head.
I understand, he said. Honestly, I'm impressed even people with shadows can remember this much. All of you know these stories?
It seems to me no different than knowing all the names and statistics of current and past heroes from your favorite American football team and the moments of their careers.
Hemu shrugged.
He had a point. But you were saying, the amnesiac said, remembering their audience on the other side of the observation panel. He was supposed to keep them on track.
Yes, yes, Hemu continued, grinning again.
So Surya marries Sanjana with her father's blessing. But when Sanjana comes to Surya's house, because he's the god of the sun, she realizes that she can't bear the brilliant radiance of his light. She's unable to even be in the same room as him, let alone look at him.
Sad, no?
The amnesiac nodded.
This is the interesting part. To escape the blinding light, Sanjana takes her own shadow and makes it into Chaya, an identical copy of herself, then transforms into a mare so Surya won't recognize her. She flees to the forest, leaving Chaya in her place to take care of the house and manage her domestic duties. Sometimes Chaya is referred to in the Rig Veda as Savarna, same kind, identical to Sanjana because she was made from her shadow but mortal.
The amnesiac realized he'd been leaning so far forward in his armchair that the back two legs had begun to hover a hair off the ground. Stories, yes, but he felt like Hemu was trying to get at something. The pieces seemed like they belonged to the same puzzle, even if they went at the other end of the finished picture.
What happened? He asked.
Hemu shrugged nonchalantly.
Surya eventually figures out Chaya is not Sanjana, and goes to the forest and finds his wife, hiding in mare form. Sanjana's father then manages to reduce Surya's brightness by 1/8, enough that Sanjana can bear the light, and she comes home.
The tone of Hemu's voice as he said the last sentence sounded as though he'd reached the end of the story. The amnesiac glanced at the tinted viewing window, confused.
But what about Chaya? He finally asked.
Some versions say she leaves, but most say she stays as another wife. The gods sometimes have multiple wives.
The amnesiac blinked.
That's it?
What do you mean?
I mean, that's the whole thing? There's nothing more.
You are unhappy, Hemu said uncertainly.
No, he said. No, it's just that I thought maybe there was something else, something that might help us. I didn't know it was just going to be a story.
I think if there was something that was going to help us, we'd already have thought of it.
Hemu snorted bitterly and looked down.
I just like the ending, that's all. I just thought, wasn't it nice that Sanjana and her shadow were able to be reunited, and then the shadow stayed?
He trailed off.
That would be nice.
The amnesiac leaned back in his seat, abashed. Hemu straightened his white tunic gently until there were no creases where the skirt bent across his lap, slightly embarrassed. The amnesiac could see how young he still was, just barely a man in either of their cultures. Behind the walls, the machines whirred softly, recording brainwaves.
Hemu, I'm sorry,
the amnesiac finally said. The story had ultimately gone nowhere, but Hemu was right. Even if there was no lesson, it was worth more than that. The resonances with the strange things happening now, the knowledge that at least there in India, millions of others would remember the same names, the same stories. Dr. Zadeh had asked him to talk with Hemu, to try and connect with him. It was not his job to turn their conversations into scientific evidence. It was just his job to listen.
I'm honored you wanted to tell me Surya's story, to include me in this giant shared memory. I doubt I would ever have heard it otherwise, if...
He folded his hands.
I don't think I remember any stories like that to give you.
It's all right, Hemu said. Maybe you can remember mine for me when I forget.
I hope you don't forget, the amnesiac said.
But you'll remember them anyway, Hemu asked.
Of course. As many as you want to tell me.
We suited up three of Altcliff's kitchen staff and two of the wedding band, the cello and the violin in makeshift hazmat suits, created from trash bags, rubber dishwashing gloves, five sets of goggles that came from who knows where, and as much duct tape as we could gather. The rest of us dug the graves. You and I made Marian's with a shovel and a bucket. We were on the far slope of the mountain, on the opposite side from where the resort was built. I didn't see her again after that last time. Once the decision had been made, you held me so I couldn't run for her. It probably didn't matter. She wouldn't have remembered me anyway. I tried not to imagine what it would be like to open 5 locked doors and shoot 5 human beings, and then carry their silent, heavy bodies so far. I tried to concentrate on the digging instead. I wasn't sure I'd ever dug anything so deep before. Halfway through, I couldn't feel my arms. By the end, I couldn't feel anything at all. When it was done, I wanted to lay down in the wet coolness of the earth. The hole was so low that the walls of it cast shade over me. The dank chill on my skin was colder than I had felt in months. I wondered if Marion was the last person in her family to die. Or the first. The sun was setting. You were leaning over the muddy edge, peering down at me sitting in her grave. Slowly you reached down. I took your hand, and you hoisted me out. "They're ready to bring them," was all you said. The bodies. The fire that night was quiet. No one wanted to ask if we'd done the right thing, because the possibility that we hadn't was unbearable. You and I sat close together, my arm looped tightly around yours. We all watched the flames. The next morning we found Rabbi Levinson dead in the ballroom, propped peacefully against the bottom of the bar counter, an empty bottle of pills in his left hand. Ye'un's name was on the label. His shadow was still there, frozen forever beneath his still form. 3 weeks later, no one else had succumbed to the epidemic. It rained for a couple of days, and we all moved back inside from the lawn until it stopped. The sun was so bright and clean after that, we moved right back out. That morning, you came and found Paul, Emmanuel, and me working in the garden we were trying to start.
I don't think you're supposed to bury them that deep.
Paul pulled half of the dirt I'd pushed over the seeds we'd found while poking around the safe part of the mountain. We don't want them to wash away if it rains, I argued.
The monsoons are almost over, he said.
His hair had started to grow out of his haircut, the front now tied up with a rubber band so it didn't fall in his eyes. I wondered what my own looked like. Probably as large as a cloud over my head.
That won't happen. Don't cover them so much.
She's right,
you said, and your shadow rolled over us as you reached the garden. The arms propped themselves on the hips, and it cocked its head the way that you always do. I watched the dark shape for a moment as it lay over the ground, and wondered if I saw it wandering alone if I'd recognize that it was your shadow, or if I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Everything okay? I finally asked you. Paul stood up and brushed the dirt off his hands against his jeans, and Emmanuel copied. I could tell from the look that passed between the three of you that it wasn't.
Guys, I said.
Come with me,
you replied. You motioned with your head in the direction of the small creek that ran through the thicker part of the woods.
Just want to talk for a second.
You nodded at Paul and Emmanuel.
We'll be right back.
All right,
Paul said. There was something strange in the tone. As if it had been a surrender at the end of an argument, not a casual comment. You looked at each other for a long time before he squatted back down. He led me into the trees, over to the small stream. The water smelled almost sweet. I took one shoe off and nudged a few pebbles from the edge of the bank into the softly gurgling water. You copied me.
Blue,
you said at last. Your voice was tight. I stopped and looked at you, as you took my hand and looped your fingers tightly through mine. I knew why you were crying then. You were crying because Paul and Emmanuel had finally decided. They were going to make a break for it. They were going to leave Elk Cliffs. They wanted us to come with them. And you didn't want us to. Ori, I said, We can make it if we're careful. We can...
We're staying here.
Your voice cracked. I looked down. Let's at least talk about it, I began. I could feel the panic setting in. I had to convince you. We had to go with them. If we stayed here, we'd be the only ones left eventually. Then we'd never go anywhere again. We'd die or lose our shadows here. Maybe more guests might join us, so we can make a bigger group. Or a safer...
We're staying here,
you repeated. The words were so final, I didn't know what else I could say. Ideas raced through my mind, one after another, none good enough. I already told them we were going with them. Weeks ago, I finally stammered, throat tight. I told them you were in. But you didn't say anything to that. You just shook your head as the tears began to slide down your cheeks, and then looked down the mountain, over the trees below, into the setting sun. I didn't understand at first why we had come so far just to talk. We all argued in front of each other now. No one cared about privacy anymore. The glow from the sun filled up your eyes, lighting the tears on fire. Then I did. You'd already spoken to Paul and Emmanuel, long before I ever had. They'd tried to convince you to let us leave the mountain with them and travel together to find either my family or Emmanuel's. And you'd refused. You'd refused. To save our lives from whatever was out there, even though it meant never seeing them again. You'd told them not to let on if I asked to join. To lie to me. That when the day came to leave, to not say goodbye to us. So it would be too late to do anything by the time I realized. There was no chance to convince you to let us go with them now because they were already gone.
Orlando Jong. The noon sun was bearing down, cool but bright enough to make Ori sweat. There was still no sign of Max. He wiped his brow and scooted farther off to the side of the road, to walk under the shade of the trees. McLean had become some kind of subtropical wilderness, but warped. Along the roads, single human limbs, twisted into strange shapes and in various states of decomposition. Entire neighborhoods charred to blackness. Weird, chilling shrines of everyday objects haphazardly placed in strange corners, people's last attempts to try to collect and remember themselves. Tunnels, dug a few feet into the grass or asphalt, all empty. The shrines were both the best and most worrisome sign. There were far more of them here than in the suburbs of Arlington he normally patrolled. More shrines meant more people to ask about Max. But the kind of people that made shrines were shadowless people. The little altar just ahead of him on the shattered sidewalk looked freshly built. A stack of salvaged objects that made no sense together, their only connection being that they'd been found in the same place because they'd belonged to the same owner. An owner who didn't know why they were important anymore, only that they were, because they held answers to a past he or she could no longer remember. There was a tattered teddy bear, a faded paperback book, what looked like a pair of boxers, a hammer, a box of condoms, and a pile of dead AA batteries. Ori touched the cover of the paperback. It was dusty. The pages curled from having endured rain and dried countless times. He didn't see them often anymore. Books. Maybe people had used them for kindling. Every time he did, it made him think of Paul. His own beautiful covers decaying on bookstore shelves now. His poems that no one was ever going to read again.
He hoped that however Paul and Emmanuel had met their end after they left the mountain, it had been kind and quick. The moldy spine almost fell apart as Ori edged the cover open. Bookstop used books. No name. He heard the shadowless before he saw it, a shifting of leaves in the green ahead. Ori backed away from the sound slowly, turned to run. But instead of an empty road, there was a man standing there, a broken-off table leg in his hand. "Trees play tricks," the shadowless said. His words were syrupy, struggling. "Willow tree, very tricky." The trees shifted again around them, tossing the sound so then it seemed to come from the left. For an instant, Ori was almost sure he'd seen a face, but made of bark, not skin. The leaves rustled even though there was no wind in them, as if laughing. "I don't mean any harm," Ori whispered, even though his shotgun was leveled at the man. The shadowless snickered. Nothing copied him on the asphalt. "No harm," he said, pointing at the gun. "But you have the thunderstorm." Ori winced, but it was too late. He thought of the deer outside his and Max's shelter, his hunting knife. The Remington still looked the same in his hands, but there was no way now to be sure what would come out of the muzzle, what a memory of a thunderstorm might mean. "Okay," he agreed. He lowered the gun and held up one empty palm in a signal of peace. But the man wasn't looking at Ori anymore. "Shadow," he said softly. "It doesn't come off," Ori almost said. "There's no way for me to give it to you." "I just want to keep going," he smiled. "I have to keep going that way." "Way for trade," the shadowless said.
"What?"
"Way for trade." The willow trees rustled. He pointed at the road, then held out his hand. "Way for trade." He wanted something in exchange for letting him pass, Ori realized. He dug into his pockets frantically for everything he'd brought from the shelter, aside from the gun and the last of his dried jerky meat, a pouch with sewing tools, the sliver of his last bar of soap, a first aid kit, and a few Elk Cliff's pens. The shadowless watched him impassively as Ori held them out, unimpressed.
"No. No good." "I don't have anything else," Ori answered. His legs tingled, ready to bolt. "But Shadow does. Shadow knows things."
"No," Ori started.
"Yes,"
the shadowless insisted. The table leg came up, and he pointed it at both Ori and his dark twin.
"Shadowless has questions. Shadow has answers. Ask Shadow who I am. Then you pass."
"It doesn't work like that," Ori said helplessly. "It doesn't know things about others. It only knows things about me."
"Ask anyway,"
the shadowless hissed. He pointed at the shadow again.
"Ask it."
Ori raised his hand, surrendering. Was there anything about the man he could glean from just looking at him? He seemed to be under 30, shorter than Ori, possibly Hispanic, possibly once in very good shape and not starving, when there had been stoves to cook better food on. There were scars across his forehead, and he wore a tarnished gold ring, but not on the correct finger to mean he'd been married. The shadowless growled. Ori turned to face his shadow fully, tried to make eye contact with it on the asphalt, as if he were having a real conversation with it.
"Do you know anything about this man?" he asked the dark shape.
He paused for a moment, pretended to listen. He wanted to give the Shadowless an answer and escape as quickly as possible. But he also wanted to ask him about Max, about where she had gone, what Ori was heading into. The woman and her crew on Broad Street had said something bad was growing in D.C., but no more than that.
I see.
The Shadowless nearly crumpled to his knees. His eyes gleamed.
What did it say?
He begged.
It said that it cannot be sure, but it thinks that it might know something about you.
Ori held up his hand.
But first, it needs to know one thing. Did you see a Shadowless woman pass by here within the last few days?
No,
the man said. It meant nothing. She easily could have come past when he was asleep or busy or gone another way.
All right, one more thing.
No more, he warned.
It has to be sure it has the right person, Ori said, gesturing to his shadow.
The Shadowless raised the table leg threateningly. The message was clear. Ori gritted his teeth and nodded.
Okay, no more.
He could feel the shape of the table leg through the air as it trembled in the man's impatient grip. Every inch of his skin was attuned to it.
What shadow say?
The Shadowless asked again. He scooted closer, like a child trying to sneak his way onto Santa's lap. The trees hissed excitedly. There was a face again for a moment, like a woman carved into wood, with leaves for hair.
My shadow said, it's certain now.
Ori smiled, trying to sound confident. There was no way he could know if the Shadowless would remember the real answer to what he tried to make up. His only goal was to confuse the man long enough to make a run for it while he pondered the answer.
It said that your name was Jeff, and you taught the trees how to talk to you.
They watched each other for a long second. Ori and his shadow both slid their feet an inch to the left to bolt.
Lie! Shadow lies!
The Shadowless screamed. The trees shrieked with him, enraged.
Wait!
Ori put his hand up.
Lies! Wife taught the trees!
No, wait!
Ori cried as the man broke into a full sprint for him. The trees howled, branches creaking as they stretched.
The shotgun, he thought.
Stop!
The Shadowless did not stop. Ori jammed the cartridges.
Come on!
Stop!
Come on!
The brake action snapped shut. Shells clicked into place. The Shadowless raised the table leg and lunged. When the man landed, a few feet behind where he had originally taken off, he stayed standing for a moment. The bang echoed into silence as they both waited. Him to find out if Ori had missed. Ori to find out what the gun now did at all. Then he fell. Ori ran to him and stared. His chest was split open. Two sides parted like clouds in the sky. Inside it wasn't red, but dark, deep blue and churning. There was a bang again from inside, and live white tendrils snapped, lightning snaking out from inside, electrocuting in agonizing bursts.
Oh my God,
Ori said.
Thunderstorm?
The Shadowless whispered between jolts. His eyes kept track of Ori's shadow as it breathed in time with his body, trembling over the dirt. He watched it as closely as he watched Ori, as if he wasn't quite sure which one of them was in control and which one of them had done it. His eyes were amber pools, flecked with gold in the deepest parts, that glittered when the current went through them. Around them, the trees hushed, as if alive, as if afraid, or perhaps in mourning. If the fragment of the woman who had once been the Shadowless's wife still remembered anything at all. Ori couldn't leave him like that, to suffer for who knew how long, but he was too scared to use the gun again. His hand scrambled at his belt for the knife.
I'm still here, Ori. I'm still alive. I still remember. I'm in Oakton now. I walked all night. By dawn, I'd made it to the Chain Bridge Road exit under the I-66 West. It's very quiet in this neighborhood, but the townhouses are so lovely. The kind I always wished we might have one day. I imagine that before the world ended, there were kids riding their bicycles up and down the clean, smooth asphalt, and mothers standing in clusters on their front lawns with strollers, checking their ornate wrought iron mailboxes, planting tulips along the borders of their driveways. It was that kind of place. I mean, I even saw one lone bicycle on a later street, mournfully pedaling itself in slow, lost circles, waiting for its child to come back. It looked so sad, Ori. Just west of that was a high school. Oakton High School, judging from the part of the sign that was still upright. I know schools aren't the best places to scout alone. Too many hallways and rooms. Too many places for others to be hiding. But I was exhausted and wanted to get out of the damp dawn. I crossed the overgrown football field and found myself standing in the middle of the campus. Someone definitely lived here once. Many someones. There were the remains of their abandoned camp everywhere. Discarded scraps of clothing, piles of trash neatly pushed into corners, scuff marks on the concrete like something heavy had been dragged back and forth. Maybe a table or chairs. Some classroom doors were barricaded. Some were removed from their hinges to allow sun and moonlight into the small rooms. Windows had rudimentary dressings over them. That's when I saw the drawings. It hadn't been a shadowed survivor's camp, I realized as I walked around in the silence. It had been a camp of shadowless. Perhaps they started together, as friends or family, and then all slowly forgot. Or perhaps they all gathered together once they lost their shadows and found comfort and protection in numbers. One of them had been a very gifted artist. A man, I think, because in all the drawings the same person appears, a pale shape with short light hair and two dots of blue for eyes. I think he was drawing himself. There was no writing in most of the signs, not like the rules you and I made in our shelter. These were signs made of images, carefully rendered in a set of permanent markers or paint. Almost all the colors were there, black, blue, red, green, purple, orange, and brown. The pictures were everywhere, next to every little thing that might be confusing to someone who no longer remembered what it was. There were pictures to describe how to light a fire, how to extinguish it, never to touch it, what a sweater or scarf or jacket was for when it was cold, that people with shadows could be dangerous to those without. I stood in front of the wall where that one had been drawn for a long time, staring at each careful line of that warning. It was painted near the entrance to the school, where they would see it every time they went to the gate to investigate a sound. Near the back of the campus, the drawings became simpler, less instructive. They seemed not to be depicting how to perform a task or how to avoid a danger, but were more a visual history of who each person in their group had been. There were 12 of them in total. Some were men, some were women. The blue-eyed man was there, next to a stern figure in the center. Their leader. On one side, another woman with long, light hair embraced a brown-haired man, both of them looking at each other and smiling. The artist was trying to tell them they were a pair, that they were in love. The last picture I found was of the same blonde-haired, blue-eyed man. It looked like perhaps the first one he'd drawn. It was larger, and there were details about him not present in the others, as though he was still figuring out how to ensure that he could recognize himself, trying to make certain there were enough clues. In the drawing, the blonde man was standing face forward, arms at his sides. His expression was peaceful. Beneath his feet, there was the unmistakable black shape, stretched out at a gentle angle against an imaginary ground. It held the same calm position, arms at its sides, its hair tousled in an identical way. Where their shoes joined together, The blonde man had connected them so perfectly there was not even a sliver of the white wall between their two sets of feet. I moved closer until my face was almost pressed against the dark space on the wall where he'd drawn his penumbral twin. He had given the shadow blue eyes, too. Two piercing sapphire dots floating in an expressionless black sea.
Naz Ahmadi. 6. That was the number of people Naz had to kill on their way. 3 shadowless, 3 shadowed. She remembered their faces sometimes, even the ones she saw only for an instant, if not less. Once in a while, their features were even more vivid to her than others she knew far better. Rojan, her mother, her coach. Memory was a strange thing. She killed the first 4 as she and her sister moved south through Connecticut on their way to New York. 2 shadowless, 2 shadowed. The 2 shadowless ambushed them as they passed the hideouts, biting and scratching. Crazed, starving. Naz didn't want to kill them, was afraid of killing them, and she and Rojan tried as hard as they could to just get away first. But the shadowless wouldn't give up. The 2 shadowed ones were starving for something else. For those, Naz did not hesitate. Just past Hartford, it started to get a little easier. They moved only at night, avoiding large towns and keeping to the rural areas. Naz couldn't have said what New Haven or Springfield looked like. The bow kept them alive. Naz was careful and managed to hunt so that Rojan could chase after and retrieve most of the precious arrows she loosed to use again. She shot little things, rats, pigeons, and they ate them raw, afraid a fire might attract attention. They ruined a lot of their spare underwear that way. They didn't die, but almost. Some nights the taste was so revolting, one of them would throw it all back up as soon as she'd finished eating it, then cry at the waist as the other one held her, at how they both were probably starving to death. When the sisters stopped for evening camp just north of Poughkeepsie, in a particularly wooded area, Naz couldn't take it anymore. Rojan had the shakes, and Naz was almost too weak to pull back the bowstring. She made a tiny fire to cook their dinner for once. It took about 20 minutes before they were found. Naz heard it first to her left, a snapping twig. She threw herself against the trunk of a tree and trained her bow on the undergrowth.
"You see it? I don't see it,"
Rojan whispered from against another. Branches, darkness, another sound dangerously close. Naz tried to aim, but she couldn't make anything out. The glow of the flames blinded her, lighting the night so that whoever was hunting her could easily see into their camp, but she couldn't see beyond it. She kicked the ground, tossing dirt onto the fire to suffocate it.
"Oh, God, no!" someone howled. "No, no, no! Why? Why?"
Rojan screamed, and Naz almost lost her grip on the tail of the arrow. A man stumbled hysterically out of the darkness at her and fell to his knees. Naz screamed this time. Her arrow went wild, missing him by 3 lengths as she scrambled for another, still shrieking, the man still crawling. She and Rojan had been so careful to avoid attracting attention, certain that there were predators around every corner. But there really must have been no one but the 3 of them for miles that night, Naz realized later. They made enough noise in that moment to alert an entire city. Rojan yelling, Naz shouting and circling her enemy, aiming the glittering slate tip of her arrow at his head, and the man moaning, hands scrabbling in agony through the dirt.
"Stay down! Stay down!" she shouted at him. "What the fuck is the matter with you? You move an inch and I'll kill you. I will kill you."
"The fire," he was wailing.
Finally, Naz focused on him long enough to realize he had a shadow, dimly lit by the moonlight, hunched beneath him on the ground.
"The fire, the fire,"
He looked at her like she'd murdered a child.
Why did you put out the fire?
Naz let Rojan light the tiny flame again, eventually. The man's last name was Wright. He refused to say his given name.
I don't want to talk about it, he said. Please don't make me talk about it.
They didn't make him talk about it. After an hour of questions, Naz finally felt safe enough to lower her bow. Her arms were so badly cramped she couldn't move her fingers for a good while afterward. Wright didn't know how to make a fire or hunt, but he did have a lot of water and a huge camping-type rubber bladder he'd found somewhere. Naz and Rojan offered him a third of their roasted squirrel once they cooked it, and he gave them as much of the water as they could drink. The next morning was the first time Naz's piss wasn't uranium yellow, and she couldn't say how long.
I came north through the Bronx,
Wright told the sisters as they picked the tiny bones clean and then sucked on them.
Something happened in Midtown near the Empire State Building. Something very big. That's when I knew I had to go. I doubt there's anything left now.
We were heading for New York, Naz said.
She slipped her bow over her shoulder again and pressed the palms of her hands into her eyes. Vague colors swam against the pressure. It felt nice. Now what?
I don't know where to go instead.
I don't know where I'm going either, he replied. Can I come with you two?
Naz said no, and Rojan said all right. In the end, Rojan won the argument. Wright could carry a lot of water in the rubber bladder, enough to split between three people, and he could make their endless night watches into bearable shifts. The going got much smoother. Naz still didn't trust him, but with more sleep and better hydration, she had to admit they moved much faster. As they passed Hoboken in New Jersey, the three of them went to the edge of the Hudson River to look across at Manhattan, just to see. They stood on Sinatra Drive, just before the shore, staring out across the dark water. The moon glimmered, its reflection spliced by ripples.
Is that really?
Naz trailed off as she stared.
Yeah, Wright said. That must have been what everyone was screaming about as it killed them, neighborhood by neighborhood.
They stared. New York was being destroyed by its own monster. At least three times her original size, the Emerald Woman rose up between two skyscrapers, the huge torch in her hand blazing with real fire. With a deafening roar, she lifted the tablet in her other arm and brought it down on top of a building, flattening it to the ground. Shockwaves skipped across the water as the green hands tore into the wreckage.
I can't believe you made it out alive,
Rojan said softly.
I know,
he sighed. They watched it for a little while longer.
To think at one point I thought maybe I could just wait it out if I laid low enough.
Naz couldn't understand what she was seeing.
It's almost kind of beautiful,
she finally said as the giant woman tossed the hem of her long robe behind her, crushing everything in its path. Glass and metal sprayed like silver confetti as buildings collapsed. Somewhere just south of Central Park, from where the statue had been a few minutes earlier, an explosion rose up in an angry dark cloud. Her crown glinted in the orangey dusk.
Horrible, but beautiful.
They camped on the shore that night and ate crayfish they caught along the bank. Wright still wouldn't tell them his name, but he told them a lot of other things. How he watched Boston on TV. How the forgetting overtook New York. How he should have left with his friends when they said they were going to steal some motorcycles and head south.
Have you ever heard about the one with one eye?
He asked them as they huddled near the small flame.
The one with one eye?
Naz repeated.
Or maybe it was no eyes. That's what my buddies were calling it, him. Anyway, whoever it is,
Or was. Wright paused. The one who gathers. That one I know I heard them say for sure.
He leaned forward as Nuz nodded in sudden recognition. That was the name she and Rojan had seen spray-painted on the side of a building just outside Boston.
My friends said he was in New Orleans, he added.
So they decided? Why not? There was no New York now, or Boston or Tehran, so New Orleans it was. Maybe Wright's friends would still be alive there. Maybe they'd be gathered up with all of them again, by this gathering one, whatever the fuck that meant. It wasn't much of a plan, but it was more than they'd had before. Nuz caught Rojan's gaze over the top of the fire, and saw that her little sister was grinning smugly at her. Fuck it, Nuz shrugged and grinned back. Her sister trusted everyone too quickly, but Nuz also always waited too long. They had water now, and a plan. Maybe Wright wasn't so bad after all. They made it all the way to Wilmington, Pennsylvania, before the next shadowless found them. He was in the back of the grocery store they were trying to raid, circling the aisles. Nuz had hoped he was one of the afraid ones when she spotted him. She was going to try to go around and spook him out the front door, but when he saw her, he charged. And she could tell he wasn't going to stop. He was angry. So angry. With no way to express it. No words, no writing, no hand signs. The only thing he could do was destroy something. Maybe it was the same for the monster in New York. She just didn't understand what anything was, and no one could tell her. Wright was far across the store with Rojan, but after the first moment of shock, Nuz was calm. The Shadowless didn't seem to recognize the arrow as Nuz pulled it quickly to the string and drew it back and did not dodge. He just kept running straight down the aisle, straight for her. That was good. It made it so she could aim an instantaneous, painless end. Her fifth of the six kills.
"What's going on?"
Wright cried as he careened around the corner of the aisle. Rojan was just behind him.
I heard the shot, Oh, Jesus.
I'm okay,
Nuz said. Rojan hugged her. All she could think about as she squeezed her back is that if it had been Rojan who found the Shadowless and not Nuz, Rojan could barely keep a backpack on, let alone fight someone to the death. Thank God Wright was with her, she realized.
All right. No more of this spreading out to search stores and houses faster,
he pronounced at the same moment.
Any time we go somewhere new, we need to stick together. Together is safer.
For once, Nuz agreed. She killed her final sixth person in an open field under a moonless night, one day south of Baltimore. It was Wright. It had been Nuz's turn to sleep. Wright was up to take over watch, and Rojan was already dreaming beside her. For once, Nuz set the bow down beside her instead of looping it over one shoulder. It was giving her such a neck ache to rest like that all the time. Her whole back was sore. She woke because someone was calling her name softly. Then someone else said,
"Shut up."
Nuz opened her eyes.
"Fuck," Wright growled. "You made it worse."
She was still groggy. She reached down to the dirt beside her, fingers searching for that familiar shape, even though she could already see that her bow was in Wright's unsteady grip, arrow notched straight at Rojan. Finally, her brain caught up.
"You know what we have," Rojan was saying. "Food we share with you, and clothes that are too small for you to use anyway."
"Bullshit,"
Wright spat. He gestured at Rojan and Nuz's bag.
"I've seen the gold. I know it's in there under all the clothes."
"It's costume jewelry,"
Rojan replied.
"From our mother. It's just sentimental."
"Then why not just give it to me?"
"Because our mother's dead," Nuz said. Wright swiveled to point the arrow at her and she flinched. Wright laughed.
"Not so tough now, are you?"
You don't know how to use it, Nuz answered. Things could get really bad.
I think they already are, he said. He pointed with his chin at the bag. Give it to me, now.
No, Rojan said. But Nuz slowly walked over nearer to her.
She bent down to pick up the duffel.
It's our mother's, Rojan said softly.
My mother's dead too, Wright shrugged.
Lower the bow, Nuz said.
Wright shook his head.
Lower the bow and I'll toss the bag to you.
Finally, he did, and Nuz tossed the bag over. He reached down with one hand and grabbed the strap, eyes still on them. The bow and arrow were in one hand. Rojan was sunken, like a hollow thing, but the tension was rolling off Nuz in waves. She was wound tight like a coil, ready to lunge at the first opening. She knew it wasn't worth the fight, but she couldn't help it. The strap of their bag dropped over Wright's head. She had let her guard down, and he had betrayed them. He had pointed an arrow at Rojan. She couldn't let it go. Even if she got shot, she couldn't let it go. His free hand started to go back toward the bow to aim at them again so he could make a getaway.
Nuz, don't!
Rojan started to say, but it was too late.
Motherfucker!
Nuz howled as she threw herself at him. They all shouted in the scuffle. Nuz went straight for his eyes to claw them out. Rojan ducked, covering her head. Wright was caught between trying to beat Nuz off him and reaching back down to notch the arrow, but Nuz knew he couldn't fire at such close range and hit her. That was true. Nuz was too close to be shot. But Rojan wasn't.
Fuck,
Wright murmured. His hands went slack.
Fuck.
Nuz sank down next to her sister. The shot had gone wild, unaimed, just a spasm of Wright's fingers as he'd lost grip on the tip of the arrow after pulling the string too tight during the fight, but it had somehow still found Rojan. Out of the top of one of her thighs, a long, slim shaft was sticking straight out like a flagpole.
Oh no!
Rojan squeaked. The ground everywhere was red with thick syrup. Nuz could see her going into shock. Her face was as white as the moon, bathed in a sweaty sheen.
Pressure!
Nuz's hands trembled as she ripped off her belt and tried to wrap it around Rojan's leg.
We have to pressure to stop the bleeding. Have to stop it.
You just should have given. You shouldn't have fought,
Wright stammered in the background.
Nuz?
Rojan murmured.
Pressure,
Nuz repeated.
Nuz,
Rojan said again, lips trembling. Nuz turned around to follow her sister's unsteady gaze. Wright was clutching the bag, staring in horror at what he'd done. The bow and quiver were on the ground at his feet, arrows scattered all around. Wright and Nuz both realized he was unarmed at the same time. They lunged, grappling in the dirt, and Wright miscalculated again that they were still much too close to use the bow. But Nuz knew. She used just an arrow. After that, she and Rojan moved much slower. To walk carrying all the bags and propping her sister up was hard. They stopped a lot, because Nuz was so delirious from trying not to sleep so she could keep watch with her bow, and because Rojan was so weak. They went back to not making fires. They never made it to New Orleans. Washington, D.C. was as far as they got. Orlando Jong. Ori crossed Roosevelt Bridge an hour after waking. Almost to D.C. Almost to Max. But when he reached the other side of the long, silent walk, he didn't recognize anything at all. Washington, D.C. looked nothing like Washington, D.C. anymore. What remained was a city that had been lit on fire down to the last crevice and then doused with winter death. Black scorch marks covered everything. The roads, the earth, the sides of buildings, the roofs were all the same burnt darkness, and from the sky, a perpetual rain fell, a kind of freezing drizzle that felt heavier than water as it settled on him. The city would have glimmered, charred onyx overlaid with diamond, if not for the dark gray clouds that trapped all light. He was a tourist at the end of the world. Just beyond the Kennedy Center, there was a group of women camped out in what once had been a luxury apartment complex's ground-level garage. The door was either gone